At a news conference, the Palestinian spokeswoman Hanan Ashrawi was queried by a man who described himself as a Christian from America and who said he wanted to address the issue of Judea and Samaria, the biblical terms Israelis used to denote the occupied West Bank. Mrs. Ashrawi bridled at the use of the terminology. She said, "I am a Palestinian Christian," she said. "I am descended from the oldest Christian community in the world. Jesus Christ was born in my country." So a moment at the peace conference that sort of relates to what we were saying yesterday. I think it's time. This is Middle East Image and Witness, the third session called Image News and Image Policies. My name is Jonathan Frerichs. Have some of you not been here before? Okay. I should say that I work for the Middle East Council of Churches, sent to them by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America as a missionary. I'm a sometime video producer and co-producer and consultant, as well as coordinating three studios that the Middle East Council of Churches has in the region. In the first two sessions that we had, we looked at images of the Middle East, which are commonly held by Westerners, especially Americans. And by and large, they're pretty negative images. And the question we asked for that session really was, will we ever know the Arabs as a people, to speak of the major group of people within the Middle East? The second session yesterday was called, the first one was Hollywood Holy Lands. Second was Basic Facts and Background. And we spent most of the time talking about the Middle Eastern Christians, who are our point of entree to the region. We have, in this unknown region to us, the place we think of as a place of turmoil and conflict and sand and oil, we have an entree because there are Christians there, and we spoke about them. We had a family tree up here that is now gone. We tried to address the question, why do we know so little about the region? Why do we know so little about this very important region, which is really, we said, the middle of the world? It's not the Middle East, it's the middle. Today's question is this: how can we understand the cycle of misperception and misbehavior that develops out of those images that define and characterize our relationship as Westerners with that part of the world? And I was mentioning yesterday something that I would do about history, and I'd like to continue that today. We spoke of some personal learning which happens when you go to the region, because the sort of bottom line of this series, these five sessions, is that it is true, empirically true, that anybody who goes to the region and listens to more than one side of the many arguments that we know about over there is changed by the experience and comes back a different person. So in that vein, I spoke of some personal experiences when I first went there, and then tried to add to them some historical information about the Christians, and this morning to continue that with some historical information about a period in political and economic history, which fits very well under today's title, which is Image News and Image Policies. As we go through this, think of the presence in the history of the images we have of the region and their impact on the policymakers and the actors, and think of the realities that we see sometimes better now with the perspective of time when we look back in this wonderful discipline called history. Before I went into media work, I was a history major, and I still enjoy it a great deal. The moment I want to talk about is really a period of about 7 years right after the First World War. But it's more than that, because it's, in a way, the end of a very interesting chapter in world history, especially for us Westerners, a chapter when we have been king of the mountain, a chapter that goes back to the European conquest of virtually the whole world, except for two parts, the Middle East being one of them. And I want to read to you a paragraph from a book called The Making of the Modern Middle East. A Peace to End All Peace is the name of the book. It's by a guy named David Fromkin. And a fair few things I'm saying here in the first part of the session are coming from this wonderful book that he's written with 10 years of research. To introduce the little period we're going to look at, The establishment of Allied control in the Middle East during the First World War marked the climax of Europe's conquest of the rest of the world. It was the last chapter in a tale of high adventure, of sailors daring to cross uncharted oceans, of explorers tracking rivers to their source, and of small bands of soldiers marching into the interior of unknown continents to do battle with the vast armies of remote empires. The venture had begun centuries before in the wake of Columbus's galleons, and we're paying attention to the 500 years anniversary, so it's part of that story. As Europeans streamed forth to subjugate and colonize the lands they had discovered, quote unquote, in the Americas and in the waters to the east and to the west of where they lived. It continued through the 19th century as Britain assumed the Empire of India and as the great powers divided the continent of Africa between them. By the dawn of the 20th century, East Asia apart, the Middle East was the only native bastion that the Europeans had not yet stormed. And at the end of the First World War, Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister at the time, was able to proudly point out that his armies had finally stormed it. So with that introduction, let's look at one of those two areas that wasn't yet conquered, and let's look at it at a time when it was still under an earlier empire, the Ottoman Empire. And we think of the Middle East as a time of a place of struggle, but you could say that up until the First World War, you wouldn't have said that, because it had enjoyed about 400 years of stability, of relative, by any standard, stability. And that period comes up until the First World War. Now, there had been a lot of things going on, but they weren't relating to so much to the local power, the Ottoman power, in the earlier part of that period. They were relating to the penetration of the region by three powers, the British, the French, and the Russian. And they had what they called, and what is called in your history books, the Great Game. And the Great Game was a game between Britain, Russia, and France to sort of see who could get the most out of that part of the world. And Russia was pushing down here, Britain was coming in from here, and France was sort of also in the picture as a buffer between the two. And we just heard that Britain had India, and they were concerned about their supply lines to India. It was one of the engines which was driving the Great Game and helped it to go. We're moving quickly through big things here, but let's just say that World War I came along, and it distracted both Russia, because they had a revolution in the latter part of the war, of course, France and Britain, virtually prostrate by the war, and it stalemated, and nothing much happened for a while. But towards the second half of the war, the Middle East began to be a place where people like the British and the French could think of actually making some gains, because they weren't making any gains on the front lines on the Western Front. They had to look elsewhere, and it looked like a place where you could do it, and they hadn't forgotten the Great Game, so the Great Game needed to be finished. And in a period which Fromkin sort of singles out and says, this is where the modern Middle East was made. 1915 to 1922, he spends a whole book looking at those 7 years. And it's a very interesting book. It reads as well as any detective novel. Britain, France, and Russia, but especially Britain, for reasons that we'll touch on, worked out a solution to the post-Ottoman Middle East. The Ottoman Empire had the region under its control for those 400 years. It was breaking up. It was the sick man of Europe for a long time, they used to call it. The British, the French, and the Russians worked out a solution for that. But they did it without very much local participation, and the local participation there was largely bought or coerced, wasn't broad at all. So that's an important thing to notice. They devised states where there weren't states. They made up states. They devised rulers. They appointed rulers. They decided who would be the boss of this state and that state and that. And they drew boundaries in this period. And the question that this raises, and the question for us is, will the people of the region accept the solution that the British, the French, and the Russians dreamed up, and especially the British, in this period? Will they accept it? It's still a question. And the Gulf War will go down in history as nothing more than a little tiny bump on a bumpy road, which is the story of whether or not that question is going to be answered positively or negatively. Will the people accept the settlement worked out by the Europeans on their behalf at that time, 70 years ago. When we look at the period, we're going to be looking at the British, but and it was the British who were the main actors there after World War I. But it suits us real well, and it's actually easier to examine them and point the finger at them. And then we can point it back at ourselves, because after World War II, we were the main actors in the region, and we still are. So it becomes very instructive on that score. And when we take the seven-year period here, what I want to do is go through about five facets of the period. We won't try to tell the story of the period. Just look at five things, as if we're looking at five characters in a drama, five scenes in a bigger play, parts of the plot. The first one that I want to put up here is that the British authorities, who by and large were sitting in Cairo, they already were installed in Cairo. They took it over after Napoleon had grabbed it, and then they got rid of him and they took Napoleon. They took Cairo as part of the spoils. They were sitting here in Cairo and scheming what to do with the region around them. So Sudan, deeply involved in a sort of a circle around Cairo. At the same time, there were other British officials who didn't agree with these British officials sitting in India, the jewel in the crown of the British Empire, also scheming what to do with the Middle East. They thought they ought to run it from India. So these guys sat there and schemed. And the image that they shared, and the culprit in this particular act of the play is Lord Kitchener, if any of you are history buffs. The image that Kitchener and his people shared of the Middle East is worth noting. So as a facet of this period, every time I pick up one of these things, it doesn't want to do. As a facet of the period, let's look at their image of the Middle East, what they thought they were dealing with. And Fromkin outlines this. First of all, they thought that Islam was monolithic. Islam was a monolith, that Islam was a centralized, authoritarian structure which dominated the region. Second thing, they lived in fear of a holy war. They thought that this monolithic Islam would rise up and chase them out of there. A holy war against British interests. Third thing, they thought that Arabs were incapable of self-rule. They didn't even dream of the possibility, apparently, that the local people could rule themselves. They saw it in terms of replacing the Ottomans with something of their own design, of course, the Ottomans being Turks and not Arabs. And then, lastly, never figured out that the local people not willing to be ruled by non-Muslims. Okay? And here's where it's a little hard to think that they couldn't have figured this one out, but apparently it didn't make it to the level of policy. The Turks were the rulers of the region, but the Turks were Muslims. They didn't notice that, apparently. But the local people were willing to be ruled by other people, but not by other people who were not Muslims. So there's a dividing line right there. And when I see that, I think that perhaps we have to not only talk about their image of the region, but their image of themselves. I think when you get so full of yourself and what you can do for the rest of the world and how good you are as a civilization, you can make this kind of a mistake in your brain and in your government. The second facet of this period that we can talk about is that the planning for the future was done by outsiders. Okay? And I'll just mention one guy. You might have heard of him, Sir Mark Sykes, the guy whose name is on the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which some of us read about during the Gulf War, as the agreement which set the border there that Saddam Hussein decided he wasn't going to honor. This was a young British fellow. His picture's in Fromkin's book, and he looks about 32 years old. And he became a Middle East expert in the British colonial administration. He spoke widely and began to be listened to. And he did things like, they're not bad in themselves, they're kind of interesting, but they add up. He chose the term Mesopotamia for what we call Iraq. Now Mesopotamia is Greek, as we know, between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. It goes back to Abraham and before him. But he decided that this would be called Mesopotamia, and called it gave it one name. But in giving that one name, he ignored the fact that you had in that area Sunnis, who are sort of the Catholics of the Muslim world, and then Shias, who are sort of the Protestants. You had Kurds, who aren't Arabs, but they're Muslims. You had Christians, who are Arabs and non-Arabs, but non-Muslims. And you had a strong Jewish community in Baghdad, at the capital of that area. Called it all Mesopotamia, thought it could all be one country. He also resurrected the term Palestine, which is an ancient, sort of an old Christian term. Hadn't been used for 400 years, neither had Mesopotamia, and started to refer to it as Palestine. He did something else, which is really quite ironic. He designed the flag. If some of you are news buffs, you've seen a flag on the telephone wires and on people's hand, in people's hands as they demonstrate in the West Bank. And it's red, black, and black, green, red, and white. That flag, the Jordanian flag looks like that. I think the Kuwaiti flag looks like that. That flag is widely used. Mark Sykes designed it. This Britisher thought the Arabs ought to have a flag, so he designed one for them. Now it's their proud flag. I mean, the Palestinians get put in prison for waving this, but it came from a guy sitting on a desk in Cairo. He also popularized the term Middle East. I said this American strategist invented it in 1902, but Sykes really put it on the map as a term to be used. So this kind of planning done from outside the region, and most importantly, his name is on this agreement, which was done between him and Mr. Pico, Sykes Pico, Mark Sykes is the Britisher, and his opposite number on the French side was named Pico, and the two of them sat down and proposed a way. This is basically their work right here, all those lines, and some of the names of the countries are theirs. But it was a secret agreement, and it was a way to decide who would get what when the war was over and when the Ottomans were truly dead and gone. And the basic gist of it was Britain gets as much as possible, France gets as little as you can make them, because I think they were a little weaker at that point when they're negotiating, and keep the Russians as far off as possible. And the Russians even signed it, because this came in 1915 just as the Tsarist government was cracking up and they didn't have much of a negotiating position. I'm going fast. Should we take a break, or anybody have a question?
Well, were there, under the Ottomans, how was it divided up, or was it was all one?
The Ottomans had a big empire, and this was sort of the heart of it outside of Turkey, and they had something called, I think they called them millets, where the different communities basically governed themselves under a ruler, and as long as he sent the taxes back to Istanbul, they didn't care what he did.
And those were likely to be smaller, even
smaller, states. Different provinces. They had provinces. Kuwait, I think, was, you know, part of an Ottoman province, and I'm not sure exactly where the boundaries were. But there was a sort of a pattern on the ground, on the landscape, which Sykes and Pico didn't necessarily follow all the time. But I think the important thing was that there was a higher level which provided unity and a lower level which provided diversity. So the Kurds and the Shiites in Mesopotamia didn't have to get along with each other. They had their own groupings, their own communities. And it was within that system that the Christians survived fairly well. They had to settle to be in a minority. They couldn't be powerful. There's no way they could be powerful, but they could be separate. So a different approach. And it's an important distinction to make, that they took a totally different animal and superimposed it on the region. One comment on the Sykes-Picot agreement. The Americans look all right at this point because they had an interesting president, probably the caliber of Jimmy Carter, Woodrow Wilson. I don't know too much more about him, but his chief advisor, Colonel House, read the Sykes-Picot agreement when it was leaked a couple years later. And his comment was this, 2 years later, "It is all bad, and I told Balfour so." Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary who was part of the negotiations. "They are making the Middle East the breeding ground for future wars." This is a guy who probably didn't know anything about the Middle East. He read the agreement, he said, "It's bad. There are going to be future wars." The third facet to talk about here is the British Prime Minister at the time, Lloyd George, David Lloyd George. And this guy, I think we need to just deal with. He's a wonderful man in many ways, but the parts about him that interest us are that he was a Christian Zionist, and he was also a fairly rabid empire builder. And it's under him that the British Empire reached its zenith. And when he turned to the Middle East, late in the war, and a bit stalemated on the Western Front, where else could we make some progress in this world at this time, keep up the British Empire's growth, he decided that it would be, as a Christian, he believed, he'd been a lawyer for the early Zionist movement, he'd been a lawyer for Chaim Weizmann, I think, in the beginning of the century, and he decided that it was part of God's plan that the Jews return to Palestine, and he was going to help God work that plan out, and he didn't mind expanding the British Empire while he was going about that. And his first big break came as he had a few spare troops to send over there. In 1917, a general named Allenby, sometimes the bridge across the Jordan River is still called the Allenby Bridge, was on his way in towards Jerusalem in about November, October, and Lloyd George said to him, take Jerusalem by Christmas. And his words were, regain for Christendom possession of its sacred shrines. So you have a British army closing in on Jerusalem, which has been in the Muslim hands since yesterday's session. Remember, they took it back in 1092, I think, or 11. No, I think 1092. I might be wrong about that. But it's been in Muslim hands for about 800 years, if I'm not mistaken. And Allenby took it back just before Christmas in 1917, much to the delight of Lloyd George. He succeeded in his two goals. He didn't get this one during his lifetime, because of course the State of Israel didn't get founded until 1948, but he gave it a good start under his prime ministership. But the second one, he succeeded. The British Empire reached its largest size under David Lloyd George at the end of this period here. It is said that he added 1 million square miles by the way he settled with the other countries after World War I. Added 1 million square miles. And somebody commenting on him said that he got a pocket full of German colonies, Mesopotamia, Palestine, etc. And it added up to 1 million square miles, added to the British Empire. As if they didn't already have enough, it stretched from here to there, from, I don't know how far away, well, from Britain, you could say, out into the middle of the Pacific. And they could virtually go territory to territory, from Cape Town to Cairo to India, between their what they owned as colonies or controlled as colonies and mandates at the end of the Second World War, when the settlement was made after the First World War. The largest empire in world history, ever. The second thing, I should say a little bit more about that because we've always heard about it, and here's where it happened in this period. 1917 is the date of the Balfour Declaration. I mentioned David Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, Lloyd George's contemporary, and this was a declaration that Britain finally supported a national home in Palestine for the Jewish people. And there's debate about whether it was meant to say in Palestine or of Palestine. Do they get the whole thing as their home, or do they just get a home in it when it was written? And there's different schools have thought about that. But one of the key passages says, the one that concerns us, I think, as people with divided loyalties on this question, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. That's right there in the Balfour Declaration. It sort of has become the fine print, I guess. And when you read it and you look back on what's happened, the six wars that have happened between the Palestinians and the Israelis, the countless riots, the countless killings and acts of terrorism by both sides, the way we're still living with the consequences, you have to ask yourself that anybody who wrote that was either real thick or real much of a scoundrel. They didn't believe it, and they wrote it, or they were just not very realistic, because it's pretty hard to see how you can load two people into one country when one is already there.
Excuse me, would you read that section from the Balfour thing again?
It's just one sentence. The declaration much longer, but this is the part that concerns the existing people there. it being clearly understood that if the Jews get this national home in Palestine, that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Civil and religious rights, you know, that's pretty much enough to live on if it's respected, and to stay where you are in your home. The fourth facet, I'll just say very briefly, but is British paranoia about an outside threat, another big power threat. And in this case, first it was Tsarist Russia during the Great Game, and second, Tsarist Russia disappeared, so it became Bolshevism, because, you know, the commies took over in the same year as the Balfour Declaration. So after the war, it was Bolshevism, but it was really just Tsarist Russia in a new coat. And an interesting fact for is Don Ring here, our geologist. If you take, he's next door. If you take the Russian story of the Wild West, they don't have a Wild West; they have a Wild East. You know, we landed here and did our Wild West number in this direction. From an earlier date, the Russians had been pushing out of their homeland and doing a Wild East number in this direction. And if you take the 400 years in which they've been expanding east and south, they were occupying 50 square miles a day for 400 years. Their march to the east and the south, so much terrain out there in Siberia and in Central Asia, that you can divide it over 400 years and get 50 square miles a day being gobbled up by the Russian Empire, the growing Russian Empire. And the British had been fighting this in the Great Game, and they continued to fight it after the war with Sykes-Picot Agreement and implementation of that, and the peace conference and all that stuff, because they didn't want Russia to come down here and threaten, once again, India. And there's interesting stories about how they tried to arrange that by deals with the Iranians, deals with the Afghanistan's people, and anybody in the area that they could deal with to try to keep the Russians out. The fifth facet, and I need a new board here, is to say that already in 1921 and 1922, the people who had made this agreement on how to carve up the Middle East on the basis of these various images that they had and ignorance of the realities, we can say with the benefit of hindsight, glad we weren't prime minister at that time, by 1921 already, the place was in flames. The British didn't really believe in the agreement anymore for various reasons. They were tired of some of their foreign adventures, and the place was exploding. And it's kind of interesting to see what was going on. You had here, from the upper left-hand corner, a Greek invasion. They invaded the coast of Turkey, where there are a lot of Greek settlements going back to ancient classical times, and they landed where Izmir is today, if some of you know the Turkish map, and pushed inland and came to the river in front of Ankara, apparently trying to make a Greek empire at the expense of their former overlords, the Turks, from whom they had only won independence in 100 years earlier, in 1821 or 1828. Egypt had had enough of the French and the British, and it sort of exploded and said, "We want independence." So that was boiling. In Palestine, there were the first of with a modern series of Jewish Arab riots. 1921, there was a big, relatively for the time, Jewish Arab riots. Iraq, this country that they had cooked up at their desks, exploded to a degree at least. The different communities, the Kurds, the Sunnis, the Shiites, the Christians, the Jewish community, weren't getting along, weren't settling into one country. And Afghanistan was in some similar trouble. And one that's pretty interesting for us, because we like oil, Arabia was sort of coming apart at the seams. Because on the one hand, you had the House of Saud, and you had the Hashemites. And both of these families, big families in the area, were claimants to be the caliph, the of Mecca, of the holiest place of Islam. And they couldn't decide who had the better claim, so they started fighting. The British had been backing the Hashemites for all through the war. Lawrence of Arabia, that was his job. He used to carry gold over there and keep them happy. Meanwhile, a guy named Ibn Saud was busy in the desert gathering other tribes around him and rising up. And of course, the British backed the wrong man. This is the House of Saud, Saudi Arabia. That's where the name comes from. So Arabia, where oil was already known to be found, was popping up. What this explosion is, besides the fact that it was an explosion and the settlement was already coming apart at the beginning of the period where we're still talking about the same settlement, the thing it has to say to us that really speaks loudly to us as Americans and what we've been doing recently is that Churchill, who at this point, Winston Churchill, was a fairly young guy. He was colonial secretary, in charge of the colonies at this point. His solution was, let's not talk to these people. Let's coerce them. Let's manipulate them as much as we can. Let's get leaders in there we can trust. We can't do it with troops because the British public is too tired from World War I. They don't want to send troops overseas. The budget's in deficit, similar things that we know about. Let's do it with airplanes. The airplane, you know what the airplane at that point of view time was. It was a biplane with, you know, they used to throw bombs out the cockpit because hadn't figured out all the nice things we know about them today. But he decided that this region could be controlled with airplanes and armored cars. And his policy was, and he sold that to the British people. They wouldn't buy an army of occupation, but they would let the Air Force do it. So a string of bases, a string of army bases with armored cars and airplanes would be a way to keep it in control. And this fantastic theory of how you deal with another people in another part of the world apparently is still pretty good, still sells. I mean, it's basically our policy today. We're not going to go in there and get our hands dirty. We did for a while during Desert Storm. But we're willing to bomb them, if the Muslims rise up, bomb them back down. Keep them in place. It was sort of Churchill's line in 1921, 1922. And the interesting thing was here, not only that they reacted in that way, but they saw the Muslims all acting as if they were together because they were rising up. This was exploding, that was and they're all Muslims and it's all exploding. Must be a plot. And Fromkin makes the point very clearly. They weren't acting together. They were acting in the same way against outside control, non-Muslim control. And in Afghanistan, it was against the Russians. In Palestine, it was against the Jews and the British, who were also occupying there by that time already. And in Egypt, it was against the British. It was reaction of a Muslim populace against outside domination by non-Muslims. Not a monolithic reaction, but a similar reaction from people who reacted in the same way. But our image stays with a monolith. Our image says, oh, they're acting together. That's a crazy region. Those guys, you know, look at it, they hate us. All these kind of things come out of the story to us. If we put this period into some kind of perspective, I think the thing that makes the most sense and has the most to tell us is two things. To remember that in 1915 to 1922, the Europeans, without much local participation, decided who and what would replace the Ottoman Empire. And that today, 70 years later, there are powerful local forces who are still not reconciled to that settlement and don't agree with it. They weren't consulted, they weren't organized at the time, perhaps, but they also weren't consulted. And you have to still say that we don't know if that settlement is going to stick. Some of the disputes that began then, like this one, is still going on. Look at the Kurds trying to break away from Iraq. Look at the Shiites trying to break away from Baghdad. Still going on. The same pot has been boiling since this period when all those people were stuffed into the same pot under a nation state that hadn't existed previously. And it's quite interesting to add up the list of countries that were created by this Sykes-Picot Agreement and much more than that as people implemented, but look at this list. Let's put Iraq first. Then we've got Israel. Wasn't created on the spot, of course, but the Balfour Agreement got the, you know, started the train on the road. Jordan and Lebanon. Now Jordan's done all right, but if you go there, you can understand that it might blow up sometime too. But those four countries, plus the two that weren't created, and you know that to not decide is to decide, right? So they decided not. At one point they were going to do a Kurdistan. They thought they'd just draw Kurdistan in, because the Kurds are one of the largest groups of people in our sort of part of the world who don't have their own country, even still today. 25 million people roughly, I think, 20 million, who don't have their own country. And they noticed that, and they said, well, we should have a Kurdistan. But somewhere in the Paris Peace Conference, they decided they wouldn't bother with that one. The other one was Palestine, if you like. Didn't get on the cards either. But those six countries, the four that were created and the two that weren't, explain a lot of where the trouble is now in the Middle East. And at a deeper level, you know, you have to say, do they have the right to exist? That's pretty much what you have to say. And that's sort of what Saddam Hussein was saying about Kuwait. And maybe Kuwait should be on the list. But at a deeper level, these states and all the arrangements that were made, including the existing entities already there, like Egypt and Syria, some of the countries that already existed but who became sort of baptized as modern nation states by this settlement of this period, we did the ultimate thing. We not only held an image of those people, but we recreated them in our image, because we recreated them in a modern Western nation state. And they knew nothing of the kind. I mean, that wasn't their way to go. They had never done that before. They did not think in terms of a secular civil government. So we projected our image onto them, right down to where we put the borders, the shape of their governments, the way that laws would be run, and the division between, of course, the secular and the religious, which was a foreign concept to them. The concept of national citizenship was totally new to the area. We don't even question these things, but we can see perhaps that it might not be the only way to go. And as some of these countries break up now around the world, especially, say, the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia and so on, people are saying, is the nation state finished? Do we need to cook up something else now? Well, the Middle East has been telling us for at least 70 years, please do. We need something else. This doesn't fit us. Because this was a strange implant in a region that was used for 1,000 years to a society that follows the holy law that governs all of life, the holy law of Islam. And when you talk to Muslims, one of the first sort of one-liners that they'll use on you is to say, Islam, that you want to ask them about their religion, they say, Islam is not a religion. It's a way of life. Part of the scenery into which this was implanted, part of the soil where this stuff has not taken root. Because they can't think of states without religion. And you see what's happened. Iran has broken out of its mold. They haven't broken out of their borders. They've tried. They tried to go over there and take Iraq, didn't they, for 8 years. But they got rid of the nation state as it was bequeathed to them by the Shah. And the Shah was one of these guys set up in this period. The Shah's father was set up as the Shah of Iran, sort of resurrecting the glories of ancient Persia. And that sort of went to his head. And it took a guy like Khomeini to go over there and put him in his place. And we think Khomeini's terrible, you know. But Khomeini is speaking for this desire to have an Islamic state. And that's perhaps a contradiction in terms. Maybe they're not talking about a state. They're talking about their allegiance to their way of life, to their religion, which is more important to them than their national citizenship. An interesting challenge for us. Is our religion more important to us than our national citizenship? And if it is, how do we react then as foreign policy originators in our own little coffee table conversations, comes into play very much here.
Well, how necessary is it for them to have a secular state? I mean, the rest of the world demands it and they don't, or something?
Yeah, they don't want to separate the two things out. Remember that this is also even an American twist. Sweden has a state church. They haven't separated state from religion. If you're born a Swede, you're born a Lutheran. So it's not the only way to cut the cookie. But our founding fathers, in what we take to be a stroke of genius, said, you know, separation of church and state. And we have a wonderful dialogue about that all the time, you know, about prayer in the public schools and how moral can the government be and how much should it get into morals and the abortion issue, any number of things. But they're coming from a much more common position, really, which wouldn't separate between religion and government. And they live then with the terrible ambiguities, which we don't have to live with, where the some of the rulers are also then have a religious status. Where we live in Cyprus, Archbishop Makarios, that's a name you might have heard of when Cyprus was formed in the 60s, he was both church Archbishop of the Church of Cyprus, which is the whole island's church, and president of the country at the same time. So, shall we vote for President Chilstrom, you know, and make everybody Lutherans? I mean,
there's another real irony is that they've slipped into the economic mold by which the rest of the world operates or functions.
Yeah.
And that sort of demands a nation state setup.
Yeah.
And that's going to be difficult to untangle.
Exactly. And I think that's part of what drives the more serious Muslims wild, you know, that they see these things going in the wrong direction. And there's a tremendous movement there to reject, you know, this Western version of progress. They're interested in the science and the technology, but not this other stuff where economics and politics get so divided from religion. You know, they think God is over everything. And they want it to be there throughout the aspects of life, and so they're willing to talk about Quranic law and those kinds of things. And I think it helps us to see that as a legitimate concern of faithful people rather than as a crazy law where they cut off your hand if you steal something, or you know, this kind of stuff, where we just pick on little tiny things in it which aren't practiced very often and are also problematic for most Muslims. I mean, they're not happy to get their hands cut off either. So,
what is the title of this book, by Robert?
It's called A Peace to End All Peace. Great title. And the subtitle is The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Making of the Modern Middle East. And it's published by Henry Holt and Company, 1990. A Peace to End All Peace, David Fromkin. British journalist who took 10 years to write it. Yeah, exactly.
Peace.
Peace. And when they got done with it, they made a peace to end all peace in the Middle East.
Do you see this as a quandary that's unsolvable with these lines and states and countries as they are now?
Boy, you just went beyond my my abilities. I think that we don't need to be too solution-minded, because we're the last people who should even open our mouths about what the solution should be. We've tried and failed, okay? And if we try again, we won't do any better, I'm sure. What I would say is, some of the things we know from faith, from what is faith? It's trusting relationship with God and with other people. That kind of sense of the validity of other people and their ideas and their ability to sort out their own problems or to make a mess of them, if you want to be a little bit cavalier about it, that needs to be exercised a lot more in the region. And if you let that go on, some things might change, because my sort of concluding thought on this one is that our interaction with the region then and now continues to be this sort of pattern where we dominate them without even really realizing how much we're dominating, because we don't even question some of our basic premises that of course they need a nation state. That's the way the modern world is. So we've dominated them in such a way that they can get madder at us than they will get mad at their own crazy leaders. And that's what happened in the Gulf War. The Iraqi people don't like Saddam Hussein. I bet you 98% of them don't like him. But we made his job so easy, you know? We make it so easy to be a dictator and a bad ruler in the Middle East, because we humiliate the area by jacking the place around the way we have done, and by imposing settlements from the outside and not letting them settle problems in their own way, which isn't our way. What do we have there? We have a bunch of demagogues whose job as a demagogue is made real easy by our humiliation of the region. And if you took away that humiliation, this might, you know, it gets into sort of armchair politics, and it's easy to say and probably hard to do, but if you took away the humiliation and dealt straight with them and let them figure things out themselves, the people would have a say, because they don't. I mean, the people, the masses in the Middle East aren't well represented in their governments. They're one-party states, they're authoritarian states. But it takes our desire to prop those guys up, like the House of Saud, you know. It's good for the oil business. It's good for our stability in the region. We work with the top dogs, and in working with us, they cut themselves out from their support underneath. And it's interesting to think of how much they struggle with this dilemma about nation states. Saddam Hussein speaks out of both sides of his mouth. On the one hand, he has exploited a nation state to the incredible profit of himself and his family. On the other hand, he appeals to pan-Arabism and pan-Islamism, you know, rise up, throw out these Christian invaders, throw out the West. If you followed one side, you'd have to get rid of the other side, because Iraq would be the first place to go. You know, you can't have a state like that. He can't be as much of a demagogue as he is if he's serious about his Islam sentiments. Yeah.
Yesterday you were saying, when we were having the Dark Age Middle Ages, obviously this area of the world was the most, by Western standards, sophisticated, mm-hmm. elegant, commercially, scientifically, astronomy, mathematics, science was the pinnacle of the entire planet. But mm-hmm. I understood this. There must be, it's not obviously therefore the people had no interest, but it was something about, as Islam took root, that the Quran, that Islam itself is not only just against growing the state, but it's somehow anti-scientific, anti-commerce, and which is why this area just basically had a maturation arrest by Western standards and just stopped growing and expanding intellectually in mathematics and science and medicine. Everything just stopped when Islam started.
Well,
which allowed this sort of thing to be superimposed on, because they became weaker, and things like the Ottoman Turks, which were a very weak people, but still dominate them. Is there something specifically in their religion or in the Quran that says this, or did it just happen coincidentally?
I think we're sort of barking up the wrong tree there, because I don't think you'd pin that one on religion. I think you'd have to pin it on overexpending themselves in terms of expansion, or other people finally taking the baton and going with it and kicking them back into place. Look at the vitality of the Turks, you know. I mean, this kind of thing has happened all along. And to lay it on Islam, I'm not comfortable with that. I can't answer you very well on the religious aspects of that thing myself. Maybe somebody else here can.
Just to mention, in the 10th century, Islamic religion was really the high culture of the world, and they preserved the Greek texts, their science was far advanced.
We wouldn't have had the Greek texts except for them.
Yeah, and so actually, I think it's wrong to say that Islam brought a lowering of intellectual standards, because there were centuries of really the highest learning in the world.
My sense would be that they were on their way. They didn't just burn out overnight. They were on their way, and if you like, they're still on their way. Because if you go there, they got a lot of life going on that has nothing to do with us. And in fact, it's the things which relate best to you when you're there. You know, the traditions, the understanding, the spirituality in parts of Islam, little I know about it, but in parts of Christianity where I know a little more. And I think we got revved up, and as we started conquering the rest of the world after about Columbus time, you know, with all those resources coming in and the energy and the expansion and the enlightenment and the scientific revolution beginning, we sort of overtook them on our terms, on the terms that we value. But you can make a great case for saying that on other terms, they never got overtaken. Try hospitality.
Yeah. I'm just saying their track as Islam took over seemed to be different from that of Western.
Bill?
But you could say the same thing about impoverished nations that have been ruled by Christianity for a number of years.
Yeah.
I don't think two things can make
it. Yeah.
While we're focusing on the Middle East, I think it's worth mentioning this dilemma of the nation states is in anywhere in the world where the British Empire came down. It's in Africa, where there's artificial boundaries. It's in the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
in Latin America.
So yep.
There's still disputes between Guatemala and Honduras and Guyana and Venezuela.
Yep.
You go way back into this business of sitting somewhere in London and making boundaries.
Right.
So
we've got a lot of strange boundaries in this world. All of Africa is drawn by Europeans, basically.
It's part of their dilemma.
Yeah.
Well, a question I struggle with, and I'll speak about the U.S. first and then about this area. 20, 30 years ago in domestic conflicts, you know, you might have a mother hitting children, and the community would say, well, that's part of the family, or a spouse hitting another spouse. And police say these are domestic matters and we won't step in, we'll let them settle it. But today we look at that a lot differently, and people are not allowed to abuse children, people are not allowed to hit spouses and damage them, but we say this is part of the entire community and we will intervene and put people in jail and make them stop these abominations. And that was a family drawing a property line around the property and saying that what we do is what we do.
Right.
Here we have, and I'm thinking of Iraq particularly, somebody who draws a line around and says, I will grind up people and I will exterminate people and I'll do what I full well want to do, and don't you meddle in our internal affairs. And then we sit here and say, are we our brother's keepers, or do we respect that line and just stay out of their internal affairs? And I really struggle with this, you know, watching people in Bosnia and people in Iraq just methodically being ground up and, and disposed of.
Well, and people in this country getting ground up too, you know, more slowly, less visibly. What we need is an international posse that goes around, have an island somewhere, and on that island they put Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
But they perhaps also put Ronald Reagan, you know, and maybe George Bush. I'm serious.
Yeah.
If we take the scale of human suffering, the U.S. has more people in prison per capita than any country in the world.
You put that on Bush and
No, no.
That's what I heard you say.
No, no. I don't put it, but I just, as a sign of a place where things are happening bad.
I agree with that.
And where the government needs to have its fingers slapped.
You put it on the government, yes.
Yeah. But he's responsible, Commander in Chief. Let's not, you know.
Let's not get into the political discussion.
Thank you.
I wanted to, I don't want to cut off. If anybody has a real need to say something more, please do. But I wanted to play you a little bit more of this one tape where these guys put together images of the Middle East and Western media. And what this is not history. This is what we see every day. And compare the difference between, you know, David Fromkin, some of whose research I hope I transmitted to you, and what you and I live by and make our decisions by when we deal with this interesting and worthy part of the world.